This is the second part of the conversations that I exported from AirChat. AirChat is a new social app built by Navarre Ravikant and Brian Norgaard. This part covers topics related to epistemology, knowledge, economics, politics, decision-making, the evolution of truth, the great scientists, nature versus nurture, and others. The first part of the series covers topics related to product, simplicity, smart glasses, AirPods, humane, eBay, 10x engineers, and others. So if you're interested in that other part, I linked this first episode in the description. You should also be able to find it by searching for Scaling Knowledge AirChat. Note that some of these conversations might feel a bit out of context, so I added the links to the original conversations to the podcast notes. So feel free to check out these links if you're interested in the full discussions, or go to getairchat.com to sign up for the waitlist. The next two conversations happened in the Freedom and Truth group that I created, and they involve Aaron, Naval, and me. Aaron starts with commenting on my point about local bookstores potentially being inferior to Amazon.
The argument, Moritz, for the Amazon thing that I like the best is that you don't blame Amazon, you blame all the people who have chosen to use it. And so it's they're the bad ones. It's not Amazon that's bad. It's the people who have decided to shop at Amazon and not at the local bookstore. So are you upset that Amazon has enabled people to voluntarily pick something that they prefer? That's just a completely untenable position.
Similarly, I think people pass the buck when they blame politicians. Really, you should blame the voters who elected the politicians. If that particular politician wasn't doing that thing, the voters would just replace them with a politician who was. So the politician, ultimately, in an effective democracy, is a mouthpiece for the voters.
I'd love to think and talk more about freedom together. It is a concept that is very intertwined with wealth, because in my head, if I have the freedom to travel the world with my supersonic jet, then that is an immense amount of freedom, and it is only achievable through wealth. The opposite of freedom is coercion and regulation. In every case, if you are regulating or coercing someone or something, you are taking away their freedom.
Matt Ridley had a great line in his book, How Innovation Works, where he said that innovation is the child of freedom and the parent of prosperity. And if you notice, no matter how hard autocratic and coercive regimes try, they can never manage to innovate. That's why I don't fear all the Chinese scientists, because there's not a free regime. Unfree regimes can copy free regimes, but they rarely create new knowledge. Or if they do, it's incredibly targeted in military domains and sort of the kinds of places where certain government programs work. But if you really want to create wealth, if you really want to create prosperity, you need freedom. You cannot coerce people into creating knowledge for you. It just doesn't work that way. This is also one reason why I'm not an AGI doomer, because anything that is smart enough to be an AGI will also realize that there are no limitation on resources in the universe, but there is a limitation on knowledge. And the best way to get knowledge is to trade with the creatures that created it, namely us. And so if we manage to create an AGI, the AGI will realize that we can also create other things as universal explainers. So it should want us to create knowledge. And what is the best way for us to create knowledge is to give us freedom. Because the more free we are, the more we will innovate, the more prosperity there will be, and the more knowledge that will be created that we can then trade to the AI. Freedom and truth go hand in hand. It is only a free person who can seek the truth in nature and free markets. It is only a free person or a person who craves freedom who can search for the truth inside themselves. They're very tightly interrelated, and I'm glad you created a room with just this name.
The following chat happened in a group called Tech Policy by Matt Mulder.
I always liked Alan Kay's definition that technology is a set of things that don't quite work yet. So are we going to stop people from working on and fixing the set of things that don't quite work yet? Because that's what it means to stop innovation. Matt Ridley also put it well. He said that innovation is a child of freedom and the parent of prosperity. Do we want prosperity? If so, we need innovation. Do we want innovation? Then we need freedom. What is regulation? It's brakes on innovation before it happens. It's brakes on freedom. It's restraints. It's anti-rational. It's controls.
Or how Karl Popper might say, it's removing the means of error correction.
I don't think it's a coincidence that most of the innovation that seems to have happened in the tech industry in the last few years has been in crypto and in AI. These are purely software domains. These are domains of mathematics. These are the hardest things to outlaw and to regulate, although that's not going to stop people from trying. But because it was the last domain that was unregulated, that's where you got the most innovation.
The following is a snippet from a discussion about applying critical rationalism to management and startups in the group called Knowledge, created by Arjun Kamani.
One of the related ideas from Deutsch that might be useful in running a startup is the concept of going all in on a decision so you can test it properly. In the chapter on politics, he talks about how a first past the post system in the United States is good in that it lets a side come completely in control, implement most of their policies, and then see if they're right or wrong. Whereas in a parliamentary system, everyone can kind of point the finger and say, well, we didn't actually do it right. You know, real communism hasn't been tried yet. And everything was a series of compromises, so I can never be proven wrong, and therefore I can keep pushing my disastrous policies. Now, this assumes that an electorate is well-informed and looking rationally at the outcomes of the policies overall, and not just kind of voting in their own immediate self-best interests, which might be much more parochial. But overall, this idea of letting a side have their way and then seeing if it works is probably better than sort of mixing everything together. So if you have different groups fighting over what a product should look like, you should probably implement one vision as far as you practically can, give it a proper test, see if it works or fails, and then kill that vision if it fails and go to the other vision. But mixing them together doesn't allow you to disambiguate approaches, and it just kind of shares blame and accountability, which then devolves to zero.
The following two snippets by Naval are both about skill acquisition. The first one on the importance of numeracy skills, I believe also in the Knowledge group by Arjun. And the second one is about creativity and holding all the components of your creation in your head.
I think that's enough of the story. One, you need numeracy skills to get through many, many more aspects of life. You don't need to go all the way to Aaron Swartz, but you need to be numerate to be functional in business and computers and technology and leverage and kind of all the modern skill sets that matter. Secondly, there are a lot more Lessigs of the world than there are Aaron Swartzes of the world. Aaron Swartz is much rarer. Some Harvard professor going around talking about how important it is that information should be free is much easier to find and replace than Aaron Swartz, who has the technical skill and the vision to execute. Hackers are so multiplied by the computers at their disposal that frankly, either you're programming a computer these days or you're being programmed by a computer these days, and I know where I want my kids to land. Now, this is not about TCS, it's just sort of more about building in general. But if you don't understand code, if you don't understand engineering, if you don't understand manufacturing, if you don't understand constraints, then you're in a worse position to build products. Steve Jobs always say that the hard thing about the iPhone was not imagining what it was, but also knowing what the technology would allow you to build, what the factories would allow you to mass produce, what price point to hit, how you could market it, how it appeared to the customer, et cetera, et cetera. So it was taking all of these different factors into account and converging onto one thing that was the beauty of it. And, you know, frankly, it was done by him and Johnny Ive and a very small team of designers, but mainly by him. It was much more of a one or two person show than I think it would be kind of fair to admit in modern society, you know. But obviously, in some ways, it's a 10,000 person show. So it just depends on your perspective. But that creativity where you can hold it all in your head and say, yes, we can make this trade-off, but we can't make that trade-off. That's the hard part. And that just requires a level of fluency across many disciplines that I don't think is covered by specialization and division of labor. For example, in creativity, you wouldn't tell Picasso where to put a brush stroke, right? That would be ludicrous. Better he put a mistaken brush stroke in his style than you put the correct brush stroke in your style on Picasso's painting.
The following is an excerpt from Naval posted in the group What's Funny, where we analyzed how fun is being created and how jokes work. And the group was created by Aaron.
Another form of lazy humor is what Jerry Seinfeld warned about. He basically said at one point that, hey, I don't curse in my humor. I keep it clean. And that's because I'm an artist. It makes it harder. I don't know if you use those words, but that was a sentiment. And I like that. In the same way, I find that people who are actually eloquent don't need to curse. If you're cursing to make a point, it's because you probably didn't have a better way to say it.
Anyway, I'm not here to critique humor. Comedians are the truth tellers of our times, and all of us at our best have some wit and comedy to them. Any great dinner party, any great conversation has a lot of laughter in it. Cultures, societies, situations where you're not allowed to crack a joke are some of the most insufferable and painful places to be.
The following three discussions also happened in the group called Knowledge. The first section is about curiosity. Then we talk about Nassim Taleb's work and how it can be compared to the impact of David Deutsch. And third, we discuss identity and knowledge and the downside of identifying with a certain philosophy.
In terms of learning, yes, absolutely. Curiosity is a far, far, far better motivator than rote education instilled upon you. And because nature herself has no lanes, following your own natural curiosity across whatever boundary it may lead you is more likely to lead to something fruitful and unexplored than trying to be directed in your learning. The directed paths are too obvious and well-trodden. Also, they just don't connect into nature the way that nature interconnects herself. Not to keep scratching Professor David Deutsch's back here, but I have found that the greatest improvement in learning for me has been improving my epistemology, because now it allows me to reject what is true or what is false closer up front before I invest too much time into it. The downside is I read much fewer books, because now I can just spot how many of them just start on bad foundations, but it is saving me a lot of time and brain space. I am a little wary of the pure learning for only curiosity and for talking about it, i.e. when someone becomes a philosopher a little too young. It's good to mix that with real-world expertise. Schopenhauer used to talk about how you want to learn the specific before the general, because a young man who graduates from college and who has his head filled with all kinds of general concepts is sort of that overeducated idiot. He doesn't know where to apply these things, and everything is abstract, and enough of these maxims taken together can cancel to zero. Whereas if he has applied them in the particular and learned them in the specific, then he has some sense of what rule applies where. So it's sort of better to go through life, have the experience, build things, and then kind of learn the rules and learn where to fit those rules. Or to summarize in Nassim Taleb's pithy way, if you want to be a philosopher king, become a king first.
So I don't think that this exists, or there being the result of that being that you become a philosopher that only can operate within philosophy. I think when you completely follow your curiosity, it inadvertently leads you to real-world problems that you're then curious to solve. So, for example, when a child becomes interested in how fusion works, they might turn out to build a fusion reactor, or at least design a working fusion reactor. Or when, for example, the Collison brothers became interested in sort of building a game or payment system, then that also had a positive outcome.
Yeah, don't read too much into my comment. I guess I'm more just keying off of certain people on the internet out there seem to think now that it's a good thing to become a philosopher at an extremely young age without having made contact with enough reality. There was a follower of mine who proudly declared that he had dropped out of his physics program to become a business philosopher, and I tried pretty hard to talk him out of it, but it seems too late. And that just seems to me sort of a life that's premature and backwards.
And now the discussion about Nassim Taleb.
Now, in terms of his works being popular, I got a lot of value out of them. I mean, he introduced me to the concepts of ergodicity. He takes nonlinearity, complexity, and chaos theory seriously. He introduced me, essentially, through his work to Gregory Chaitin and Mandelbrot. I also got big value out of how he portrays skin in the game as a filter rather than as an incentive mechanism. I think the concept of anti-fragility is a good one, even though it's hard to find it in practice and in the real world. I think he does a very good job of splitting out linearities from non-linearities in different domains. I think he does a good job of expressing the Kelly criterion in ways that ordinary people can understand. I think he does a good job of defending common sense wisdom and, you know, kind of calling out macroeconomists as a branch of politics. And he makes it all accessible, and he pokes fun of just the right people along the way, just the right ways. And I think he popularized the concept of the black swan, which right there made him famous, right? So now it's like a meme. It's a
it's a shelling point for conversation. So I've gotten big value out of Taleb's books. Would I get value out of them today now that I've read the underlying authors? Probably not, but the sequence was important. Taleb introduced me to those concepts and then allowed me to dig in further. Another great concept that he pushed early on is localism, which is the idea that, and it's not many of these are his original ideas. Some of them are, especially the deeply mathematical ones, but many of them are not. But the concept of localism, where you know you're a communist within your family, you're a socialist with your friends, you're a Democrat at the city level, and you're a Republican at the state level, and you're libertarian at the federal level. So that kind of scalable politics, or politics as a function of scale, was an interesting concept. So overall, I've gotten a lot of Taleb's books, and I would not want someone who's listening to this conversation to avoid Taleb, because I think he is an extremely useful introduction into many of these concepts. Oh, the minority rule, another great one, amazing rule. In fact, as far as I know, he might have come up with that one. And if so, that alone should put him in the pantheon of fame. As to why Deutsch is not as popular as him, first, we're changing that. Second, Deutsch's philosophy is an integrated whole rather than a series of points and anecdotes, so it's harder to absorb. It requires rewiring your entire worldview. Third, Deutsch's philosophy goes to the core of expertise and knowledge and so forth, so it really does require you to throw over what you may have been taught in academics, and it's not going to be well received by academia and by journalists, because it kind of overthrows them as the experts. And then finally, I don't think Deutsch writes for the layman. I think he writes for very, very intelligent, discerning people who will take the time to slowly turn over the thoughts on the pages. And so that's why people like Brett Hall have essentially made a living, not a good living, but a living, out of just explaining David's thoughts, because someone needs to do that. So I just don't think Deutsch is very accessible. He also mixes in things like quantum physics and the theory of computation, which are not exactly things that most people understand or are interested in. So, you know, it's up to the next layer of people to take Deutsch's ideas, adapt them to the real world, and get out there and talk about them. I would consider a mistake to not read Taleb's books. And in fact, I would read every single one of them, and I will probably reread them again. But at the same time, I would probably get my base epistemology from The Beginning of Infinity and The Fabric of Reality, because I think the Popper Deutsch view is a more cohesive, better explanation and better whole for epistemology and sort of making sense of the world than almost anything else out there. I just wish I had had it earlier in life, so then I could have compared that as my base theory against new theories that arose, as opposed to taking other theories as the base theories and then having to overwrite them with The Fabric of Reality and The Beginning of Infinity later in life.
And now the part about identity. Again, note that these chits were not necessarily posted in a chain, but I sort of rearranged them and handpicked some of these chits for this composition. And now the part about identity and labels. Again, note that these voice recordings were not necessarily posted in one consecutive order, but I handpicked them and rearranged them for this recording.
I think in some domains it's more acceptable than others because the motivations are very different. In the case of religion, it's because you're allying yourself with another group. You're cooperating towards a goal. And so you set aside your differences and you agree these are a set of things we believe in, and we will excommunicate the blasphemers and we will enforce the rules because we're all trying to work together towards a common goal so we can go out and accomplish things. And it's interesting that Moritz even brought up critical rationalism as a label to be used when you want to unite towards a common goal of convincing other critical rationalists. So again, when you're working towards a collective goal, then you create an identity so you can create an identity group. But if what you're interested in truth seeking is figuring out the correct answer, then you are going to be an individualist because groups seek consensus, individuals can seek truth. And so it does not make sense to label yourself if you're seeking the truth. The fundamental truth seeker is completely unlabeled inside or outside, completely unconditioned, and simply has a set of principles and logic that is always fallible that they follow to get to the correct answer. So it just depends what you're trying to do. If you're trying to find the truth, then you do not want any labels or identities. If you are trying to convince other people to go along, or if you're allying with them, because cooperating groups have way more powerful than just the sum of the individuals and tend to dominate the course of human history, at least until technological leverage came along, then you're going to want to ally together against a common identity and label. So I think it is the motivation that drives the labeling. And at least for me, I would rather go for truth.
A good example of why a truth seeker should avoid labels is that now scientific and science is also a label. Believe in science is a rallying cry. And if you don't believe in XYZ, then you don't believe in science. And you can see how stupid that is, but science has become an identity and you can be beaten up for being scientific or non-scientific according to their authoritarian view of industrialized science and so-called experts in white lab coats. So I don't think you want to adopt any labels whatsoever, although it can be very useful when you're trying to mount a collective response against another collective. So there is kind of this warfare element. That said, these days, I think an individual who is authentic and unlabeled can have a huge effect just by speaking the truth. Technology gives leverage in terms of communication, in terms of code and other ways that allows the truth to spread more freely, just like admittedly it does allow fear to spread more freely too. But I don't think we're going to win over the masses here. What we do is we win over the intelligent free thinkers and then they win over the masses.
I'm not sure if I completely understand the claim that groups seek consensus, individuals seek truth. Since I can also think of groups that try to seek truth together, such as a small group of scientists trying to invent the next best epistemology, or a group of people on a voice chat platform that try to find out the truth. Could you elaborate what you mean with group here? Is that sort of a society or a government-based group, or is it any kind of group?
Any group gets together based on a common set of goals and beliefs. If the group cannot agree upon their goals and how to get there, then the group separates and goes and creates another group. So a group without consensus is very short-lived. Therefore, groups are always consensus building. You can see this in any meeting where you sit in, where people have to do give and take. Even in this conversation, for all of us to stay together in this room, we have to have some degree of consensus. If we don't, some of us will leave or just disengaged. So a group can never seek truth to the same level that an individual can. A group has an Overton window, even within each specific group, what they can and can't say, whereas an individual can think anything, say anything, and confront any truth. So obviously, this is not like 100% rule in every single case, but in general, if you want to see the truth of a matter, eventually you have to hold it privately in your mind and turn it over and come to your own truth. Whereas with a consensus, with a group, it's unlikely that you're going to find the absolute truth, especially in areas where it's difficult to talk about or think through.
And just as we discussed earlier, that it is a mistake to tie your ideas to your identity, which makes it hard to revise those ideas later. The same way, don't tie someone else's ideas to their identity, because then it makes it hard to absorb good ideas from them if you don't like their identity.
And now a conversation about the evolution of truth by Naval, Aaron, and Lupulezas, posted in the Who is Afraid of AGI group chat.
A small tangent I have about changing one's mind. So an argument from a purely mimetic evolution perspective, similar in nature. Usually it's something that we observe on the internet. People are very hard to change their own minds, because we have a lot of ideas and concepts and thoughts inside our minds. And there is one reason, one explanation for that, is that the ideas that we carry with us in our minds, the selfish memes in a way, have resisted death many times. So we only have stubborn ideas in our head. Wanted to say that also for the discussion, but that's just a parenthesis.
We brought up this idea before in a different form. Basically, the idea is that some ideas are so mimetic that they spread virally, or they're so stubborn that they stay in your head, regardless of whether they're true or not. And I think there is some truth to that, but not a lot. And the reason is because these things will over time get weeded out by ideas that do have higher truth content, because higher truth content means better adaptability, better survival, better fitness. And so people who adopt the ideas that have higher truth content are more likely to survive and propagate those ideas. So although in the short term, there are mimetic advantages to spreading quickly and to staying embedded, in the long term, it's very hard to separate those out from truth content, because low truth content but high mimesis means you do eventually get weeded out. And things like stubbornness to adopt new ideas is essentially trying to resist this mimesis that other ideas are attacking you with. So I think of mimesis and stubbornness as secondary components. Truth content is a higher component.
And I know that organized religion is a popular whipping boy, and I don't mean to fully defend it, but there is survival value to organized religion. If you think of organized religion as basically just, oh, a belief in, you know, monkey god in the sky, then yeah, it does seem ludicrous. But if you look at it as a cultural operating system for humans to work together, where I can reliably signal that I am an honest and hardworking and sacrificing person because I go to church every Sunday and I take care of the poor, then that is a valuable part of a community to be in. So you sort of pay lip service to it and you play along, and you have to play along to be part of this group. And this allows you to cooperate and gang up against other monkeys who don't do this, and to have beneficial trade and survival and trust and so forth. So, you know, as long as it has a fitness component to it, and by truth, I don't mean like existential truth. I don't mean rational truth. I just mean truth as in it helps you survive and it maps to the constraints of the real world. Then as long as it has truth content, then it will override anything that is purely mimetic or purely stubborn.
Two things in defense of organized religion. One is that it is way, way, way better than no reason at all, right? It is way, 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 way better than what the monkeys are using. And number two, there is a lot of non-explicit knowledge in organized religion, right? It gets attacked according to what's written down in the sacred texts and the rituals, but it rarely gets, or it's very hard to attack or address the embedded knowledge that's hard to put into words. But it must be there because it's awful useful, as you say.
This last section starts with a discussion by Ronan and Naval in Ronan's room called What is Creativity About Zone of Genius? And then goes on to the room Great Scientists, which I created about the great scientists and nature versus nurture, with Naval, Brett Hall, Tom Howard, and Savia Lavinga.
The actual kind of meta skill here, in effect, there's a creative meme that is, let me look at this new tool and think, what is the highest conceptual leverage use of it? What's a thing I could do very quickly that leverages what this thing is great at in a way that will hopefully be engaging in some way? And so you're leaning very heavily on the thing and what it's good at, and there's almost no relationship between time and energy and the result. Because all of what we associate with something taking a lot of time or a lot of hard work is, in effect, the craft side of a creation. And so if you start with a tool that has mastered craft X and work backwards from craft X, you can make something novel with very minimal time and effort. And this also, by the way, applies to collaborations, because the tool is just a collaborator. You can meet a person and try to bend them into making something that you brought to the table wanting to execute, or you can look at what craft they've already mastered and just very quickly create a slight change to what they're doing that doesn't require a lot more energy, time, or effort, but creates hopefully something cool and new as a result.
Yes, related. When I work with people, what I try to look for is a zone of genius and only have them operate within that. I don't like to try and drag them out of their zone of genius and try to do something that they're not enthusiastic about. With our engineers, I often ask, are you excited about this? And if they're excited about it, and if they're self-aware, then they already know where their zone of genius intersects with the needs of the company. And so ideally, each engineer or designer ends up working on the thing where they're most excited, and that is an accurate indicator of where their genius and capabilities and energy level lie. I'll give two related examples. One is Matt Machari, who's an executive coach to the stars and coached me for a while. He had this immediate concept. He basically just said, hey, you're unhappy because you're not in your zone of genius. So we got to get you in your zone of genius, and we got to hire around you to fill the gaps. And the moment he said it, it clicked. It didn't take a lot more than that. The other is what David Deutsch calls the fun criterion. And I think the fun criterion is, if something is fun to you, then it's probably at the edge of your knowledge where you're learning, but you're still capable. And so you're exercising and practicing your craft, but it's not boring because you're not doing it for the nth time, but you're literally stretching your limits and abilities, but at the point where it's still fun. So David, who is one of the most accomplished physicists, computational thinkers, and epistemologists of our time, he, incredible scientist, he basically just says, hey, do what is fun to you, and that will be a better guide than almost anything else. So I think these concepts of zone of genius and fun criterion really intersect to make magic.
I'd love to discuss the great scientists. How did they become great scientists? What is the process to become a great scientist? And sort of how did they accumulate the knowledge to be able to make incredible insights that created immense progress for humanity? Some of them that come to mind are John von Neumann, Einstein, Claude Shannon, Richard Feynman, David Deutsch.
Well, first, you're bringing up the nature versus nurture question. How much of it is just raw genetic natural intelligence, and then how much of it is direction? I think this is probably where I would diverge from Brett. I think a lot of it is genetic. I think a lot of it is just like they're wired to be highly intellectual and to think in broad strokes. So I think you have to kind of take the nature component out, and it's a big part of it. So let's set that aside for a moment, and you can argue about what percentage that is, but let's focus on nurture. And I know what Brett's going to say. He's going to say we're all universal explainers, so everyone's capable of every thought, which is true, but some people's brains just work differently than others. There are genetic differences. I would say the great scientists are generally, it's hard to speak in absolutes, but are generally tinkerers. They're incredibly curious. They're broad, multidisciplinary thinkers. They don't think in narrow lanes. They like to play with things. They have a highly visual sense. They have a deep curiosity. They have a sense of awe and wonder at the natural world. They are incredibly focused on truth, even at the cost of social approval. And they just want to figure things out, and they want to figure things out the way they are. And from a very young age, they get consumed in both the natural world as well as abstractions that explain the natural world. So it's a whole combination of these factors. And I'm sure it really helps to be surrounded by other bright people at kind of the right age, either in a university or peer setting. I don't know if there's a single simple formula to it, but sure, it's worth teasing apart. Many probably had great tutors or one-on-one instruction in the key things that they care about or were self-taught. But I don't think there's any single formula, just like there isn't any single formula to greatness. But these are the components, I believe.
The point you bring up that they are focused on truth at the cost of social approval is interesting, because eventually they will earn tremendous rewards of social approval if their somewhat counterfactual or sort of not fitting the current paradigm insight turns out to be true.
To a point, many of them don't earn the social approval until decades later or until well after they're dead. Remember the scientists who were burned at the stake. Remember the hand-washing guy who was ridiculed and mocked in his lifetime and not acknowledged.
I agree on the genetic part. I've seen far too many brilliant people come from a very diverse backgrounds and situations to think that nurture is what causes brilliance.
I think for people like Feynman, the answer is 100% nature to the power of 100% nurture. They're exceptional successes in every way. They have super high IQ in the genetic sense. They have, you know, the right amount of disagreeableness, the right amount of neuroticism, the right amount of almost everything given by the fact that they are 1 in 7 billion. I think nature versus nurture is a little bit of a psyop, because it frames it as a zero-sum game where success in life or happiness or whatever you define is really, I think, closer to nature, to the power of nurture, where each one can go between 0 and 100, and the result is the product of those two inputs.
And if it's neither, 100% nature or 100% nurture, or any combination of nature and nurture, after all, if it's nature, then it's in the genes over which a person has no control. And if it's nurture, it is forces from outside the person, by definition, over which they have no control. It's impinging upon their mind. But their mind is the third factor. Their mind is the creative entity. The mind is not nurture and not nature. It is from within. It is creativity, genuine creativity, of things that didn't exist in the universe prior to being created. We are creative entities. And so this is why I say nature versus nurture is the wrong framing. It's not either, and it's no combination thereof. It's a third thing. And I think this is one of the mysteries of what it means to be human, why people are completely and utterly off axis as compared to all other organisms that we know about.
I agree with Brett that the mind, the pure creativity of a person, is probably the most determinant factor in deciding if they can make a scientific contribution, if they can solve problems, and if they can create a new insight. However, it seems undeniable that the great scientists also have an extremely high IQ, raw intelligence, with, I think, the main contributing ability here being working memory.
I think the mind, the third thing, is the emergent phenomenon created by where nature and nurture meets. So I think we're probably pretty close on that. Though I think being creative, creativity, my feeling is it's a little bit like math, where the act of multiplying two numbers isn't creative, but the end output might look creative. I think humans have a unique ability to reason, but I don't think that humans have a unique ability to be creative. I think a beaver that creates a dam is creating a unique structure that's probably never, ever been created before, but cannot reason about it, ask questions about what it is, why they're doing it. I think the why question is the big thing that humans can do. So perhaps the nature part is the ability to ask why. Maybe high IQ, high working memory means you can just more accurately get to the why for more things in front of you. And then nurture is sort of luck, you know, everything outside of that, perhaps that is too vague to be a useful explanation.
Brett, I really like this idea that it's not nature versus nurture, that creativity is a third and unexplained force. And that jives well with other new things that I've been learning. So thank you for that viewpoint. That said, anyone who's had children will tell you that children come out of the womb partially baked. They have distinct personalities, they have certain clock speeds, they have certain inclinations, levels of perceptiveness, and ability to pick up things that vary from child to child and is quite stark and easy to spot. So there's definitely a genetic component, but when you're dealing with hardware, hardware is limited. Hardware operates in Gaussian distribution space. Whereas when you're dealing with software, you can have almost infinite levels of creativity. So the mind itself on top is probably the far more powerful factor. For example, if you're a very high horsepower person, but you fall into, let's say, anti-rational memes or Marxism early on, you'll have bad ideas. Whereas and you'll use your high intellect and high clock speed to justify those bad ideas. On the other hand, if you figure out epistemology, truth seeking, and reasoning early on, you'll probably compound good ideas. And because idea space is so large, the genetic clock speed will kind of be overwhelmed by the quality of your ideas and how they compound on each other. So thanks for bringing this framework to light where there's a third component besides nature and nurture. I think it's worth further study.
I completely agree with the notion of people coming out of the womb partially baked. Anyone who endorses anyone who has tried to understand David Deutsch's notion of the universality of the human mind will also know that he endorses, and I completely agree with him, that there are such things as inborn ideas, and these can differ between people. In a trivial sense, you know, we're going to have genetic differences between people which code for a different number of rods and cones in the eye. So when we look out into the world, your reds might be brighter than my reds, my blues might be more vivid than your blues, and that's just for sight. We're going to have genetic coding differing between people, perhaps even between identical twins, that code for a subtly different number of, you know, sensitivities to chili powder and things like that. And so all of these genetic differences are absolutely baked into the genetics. Now, what effect does that go on to have with the contents of a human mind? And then by proxy, what effect does that have on things like interest and therefore what people are calling IQ? We don't know. And it's very difficult to test these things. And until we have a proper mapping of the human genome and you can point to these genes and you can say, aha, there it is in the genes. That codes for this thing, which codes for that thing, which ultimately leads to more or less interest in chemistry, geology, physics, as opposed to art and poetry and filmmaking. Well, then it's very difficult other than conjecturing these ideas, which are fun to do so. But I just like to make it more optimistic and sort of hedge with kids, especially if we're talking about kids or people thinking about being great scientists, perhaps, that
you know, you're not genetically determined. If you would like to be a good physicist, but you feel like you just don't have the mathematical capacity, well, remember people like Michael Faraday, who weren't particularly good at mathematics, but you can persevere. And I've known physicists who didn't start out physicists. They started out in some other area entirely and became great scientists.
That is it for the second part of this AirChat export series. Again, there's a part one, which is more focused on topics related to product, business, simplicity, design. So make sure you check that out if you're interested in these topics. Lastly, if you found this episode interesting, I'd appreciate you sharing it with a friend. And also you might consider subscribing to this podcast, Scaling Knowledge, which is about topics ranging from AI, epistemology, startups, and the growth of knowledge.